the whole world. Remember, in all continents of the world, they were demonstrating, demanding our release. We knew what happened. You remember in India, it went to the extent that the Prime Minister of India was saying that, why don't you release that celebrity?
A decade after the heinous massacre in Zaria, members of the Islamic movement continue to await justice and the prosecution of those responsible. Human rights organizations argue that the Nigerian government's attempt to conceal the atrocity reflects a profound disregard for human life and a blatant evasion of accountability.
We expected that indicted individuals and groups should be prosecuted, particularly the military commanders who gave the order. We also expected government, having been given the names and identities of the victim, to take steps towards restitution and compensation. Nothing has been done.
Participants at this conference said tyrants don't realize that abuse of power weakens their own system. They explained that moral leadership endures as the era of every political actor eventually finishes. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
South Koreans, together with workers from around the world, marked International Migrant Workers Day at Seoul Station on Sunday. Joining the demonstration was the father of a 25-year-old Vietnamese graduate of a South Korean university, Tu An, who died October 28th trying to evade an immigration crackdown.
The crackdown, which lasted over 3 hours, drove our daughter to her death. As a parent, I want to know the truth about what happened during her final moments on this earth.
The crackdown that claimed Tu An's life aimed to clean up the country prior to its hosting of APEC world leaders nearby.
All workers living in this land should be respected as human beings. No one should be forced to hide or run away in fear.
Nepali Udaya Rai came to South Korea 20 years ago. He suffered discrimination, workplace harassment, and unpaid wages, and says migrant workers' lives need consideration.
Neither employers nor the public understand the dire circumstances of migrant workers and often see them not as workers with rights, but as a temporary labor force to be used by capitalists.
There are about 1 million migrant workers in South Korea, and they do a large portion of the so-called 3D jobs, dirty, difficult, and dangerous. About 100 migrant workers are killed in workplace accidents here each year, and that's about four times the rate of South Korean workers.
Attitudes must change, says Udaya.
We must recognize migrant workers as fellow workers and members of society and strive together to protect their labor and human rights.
South Korean labor laws must also change, say critics, who point out that, among other problems, visas for migrant workers essentially tie them to one employer, suppressing their wages, options, and human rights. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A historic day in Iraq, as the Iraqi government officially announced the end of the mandate of the United Nations Assistant Mission for Iraq, UNAMI. After more than 20 years of its presence in the country, this comes in the light of improved security and political stability, which will allow Iraq to transition from direct international support to managing its own internal affairs.
In my view, the presence or absence of UNAMI mission makes no difference to Iraq, especially since this organization receives direct support. Unfortunately, most of the so-called international humanitarian organizations have turned into tools controlled by the United States. The evidence is clear. We have seen repeated interventions in Iraqi affairs. UNAMI had specific objectives, defined mandates, and legal and diplomatic mechanisms. But what we witnessed went beyond that, reaching direct political interference and intervention in Iraq's political decision-making.
Despite UNAMI's long presence in Iraq, political analysts believed the organization did not fulfill its true role. Instead, it influenced and interfered in political decisions, failed to manage affairs effectively, and consistently leaned toward the American side, failing to convey the suffering of the Iraqi people.
The truth is that the United Nations, through its representations worldwide in recent years, has failed miserably to be a clear mirror reflecting the suffering of people. Instead, it has turned into a tool in the hands of the United States of America. In Iraq, the UN representative reflected a specific agenda and exercised a form of imposed guardianship over the Iraqi state. As a result, the mission was only able to achieve the objectives pursued by the United States while attempting to place pressure on the Iraqi state.
This is a historic day for Iraq as UNAMI's mission ends and a new era begins, one characterized by the Iraqi sovereignty and the prevention of interference in internal affairs.
A new phase begins for Iraq with the end of the United Nations assistance mission in the country. This doesn't mean the end of cooperation with the UN, and it's aimed at further asserting Iraq's sovereignty without any foreign intervention. Nawar Faik, Baghdad.
In the midst of the Israeli regime's ongoing genocide in Gaza, a number of protesters have gathered outside the British Parliament to hold a special Christmas service in honour of all those killed in the Holy Land of Palestine. This vigil seeks to combine prayers for the people of Palestine with outrage at the British government's role in supporting the Israeli regime's genocide against those Palestinians. And attendees particularly want to draw attention to the treatment meted out to both Muslims and Christians by the Jewish extremists inside the Netanyahu administration. The protesters say that Western media and political elites deliberately obfuscate the existence of Palestinian Christians to make it easier to demonize the victims of Israel's genocide and label them as terrorists not worthy of being humanized.
There's been a lot of work done to basically depict Muslims as terrorists. No one talks about Christian terrorists or Jewish terrorists. When they think of that word, they automatically think Muslim. So that's why that framing exists right now. But we know Christians live in Palestine. We've had vicars talk about how their churches are being bombed. We know Israel attacks them. Even during last Christmas, I remember how churches were bombed into rubbles.
Members of different religious communities were in attendance to commemorate the victims of the genocide. Jewish pro-Palestinian groups concede that politicians like Bezalel, Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir have deep support amongst the Jewish settlers occupying Palestine.
And their policies are neo-fascist. They talk about annihilating all the Palestinians, the women, the children, everybody. There's no reservation about it. And Netanyahu follows this partly because he's ideologically inclined.
With churches and mosques being destroyed by the Zionist Israeli regime in the birthplace of Jesus and hundreds of thousands of people murdered, it will take serious work to break through the pro-Israel propaganda and make wider Christian populations understand what's taking place in Palestine to those they claim are their brethren. Issa Kadhimi, London.
Coordinated protests against the administration of Donald Trump continue, with activists surrounding the White House to deliver a people's indictment against Trump. From the deployment of National Guard troops in American cities to unprecedented illegal immigration raids to the axing of federal funding of government departments, Trump has inspired some activists to remain in a mode of permanent protest.
I'm 76 years old. Okay, I was able to live in the Vietnam era where Nixon had to leave office, okay? Other countries through mass protests, like South Korea, other countries have like massively stood up and nonviolent, very compelling actions to really inspire people and disrupt the workings of what's going on nonviolently. And we can do that.
The protesters say their regular actions are to inspire millions of Americans to return to the nation's capital and nonviolently oust an administration they accuse of being fascist. Economic issues continue to mount in the United States, both structural, like inflation, housing, and healthcare costs, and new, like a Wall Street bust in the artificial intelligence boom. Just 31% approve of Trump's handling of the economy, which is his all-time low, and down from 40% as recently as March.
Because a lot of people don't believe in politics, don't address it, don't see it, but they do see what's happening in the pocketbook, in their own reality. And that's the first thing that people address, Americans address.
Trump's MAGA, or Make America Great Again, base is also showing signs of fracture due to his imperialist attacks on Iran, Gaza, and Venezuela, which contradict his promises to end Washington's foreign meddling and endless wars.
Trump's overall approval rating is 36%, which is down from 42% earlier this year, but which is still rather high for a Western head of state. However, his right-wing economic policies target the upper and not the working class, and he appears to be exacerbating rather than healing America's many cultural divides. Ramin Mazahiri, Washington, D.C.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So brothers and sisters, we learned that trick of Iblis to make the dunya big in our eyes, and then after that, because it's impossible that I both see the dunya is big and Allah is big, I fall into that trap of many believers. For me, God isn't Kabir. And there's a whole list of things that happen if Allah is not great in my eyes. One of them I mentioned yesterday. The idea that if you and I take a minimalist approach to Islam, I worship Allah, I obey Him, but Allah, in my eyes, practically speaking, isn't Kabir, because He can't be if the dunya is very big for me. What happens? One of the things that I mentioned yesterday was that as a believer, I get fixated on the results of my actions. Whereas someone who considers Allah to be Kabir and Azim, that person says, Allah is my goal. Why do I do everything that I do in life? Because I want Allah. And He's everything. the results, that all of us, we're working for results, we're expecting results. The Ahlul Bayt have taught us that. You make, Imam Sadiq, you make dua, expect that the haja is at the door. The Ahlul Bayt told me to do that. I hope for those results. But if a person has ikhlas, if a person thinks Allah is azim and kabir, then the results are what we call nurun ala nur, light upon light. Great, if the results get there. Otherwise, I got what I was looking for. I got Allah. I want to give you an example, right? This might not be a complete example, but just for you and I to know. If Allah is kabir, if Allah is azim, if I have Quranic ikhlas, and I've done something that pleased Allah. Question. When you and I step out outside, you step outside, in a bright day, and the sun is out, can you even see the stars? The stars are out there, but can you see the stars? If Allah is Ali, if Allah's everything, yeah, I get the results, alhamdulillah, because Allah said be grateful. That's different than being turned inside out if I don't get the results that I want. Example. And this, I'm speaking to myself. I'm not speaking from cloud nine. All of us are trying to reform ourselves to get ready for the Mahdi. Example. I went to for ziyarah. I went under the very dome of Aba Abdullah. I held on to the dhari. And I asked Allah, and du'as are answered. Du'as are answered. But you know what? The reality is, my prayer up until now hasn't been answered. If I'm an ordinary Muslim, a mediocre Muslim, an average Muslim, I might start to, if I don't, I might not ever say this out loud, I'm a little disappointed with Allah. I made dua. I went for ziyarah. It didn't happen. Because as an average Muslim, the results are important. My dua. Was my dua answered? If my dua is answered, then I'm happy. That's very different from where Allah's trying to take us. Brothers and sisters, there's a secret. Allah wants mu'mineen and mu'minat to enjoy their life here. To really enjoy it. Not put on a face. Not I'm fronting, I'm faking. To really deep down enjoy their lives, first in the dunya and then in the akhirah. The secret is, it's impossible to do without ikhlas. Without Allah being azim, I won't be able to get all those wonderful things that Allah wants the mu'min to have. He doesn't want me to just, I'm scraping by, if I just make it, if I don't go to hell. That's a minimalist approach to Islam. Allah wants us to enjoy ourselves, but that can't happen if I don't crack the code. Cracking the code means I see Allah as a thee. So now, what else happens to the mu'min? The mu'min who doesn't have ikhlas. Now, I want to mention one more verse of the Quran before I move on, right? Just to, for us to again demonstrate and drive home that point. The idea, the first point is the idea that the mu'min is frustrated. I didn't get, life wasn't fair. Even if I'm scraping by and I'm doing the right things. But Allah isn't azim. Ayat of Quran. Brothers and sisters, can you turn with me to Surah 9 and verse number 72? If you can turn with me to 972, this verse will explain to us that a person who's a mediocre mu'min has has missed the point. I'm so focused and fixated on the results, I miss the point. So I don't go through life with a lot of joy. A verse of Quran. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Guys, do you see this? Wa'adallahu al-mu'minina wal-mu'minat. Let's read this together. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Wa'adallahu al-mu'minina wal-mu'minat. Allah has promised the believing men and the believing women jannat tajri min tahtiha al-anhar. Allah has promised us gardens beneath which rivers flow. Khalidina fiha. We will be in those gardens of paradise forever. What else? Wa masakina tayyiba. Houses, dwellings, abodes, which are so wonderful. Masakina tayyiba fi jannati adn. And we will be in these gardens of perpetuity. We never have to worry about anything. But then Allah says the secret. Well, ridwanum min Allah akbar. Those are wonderful. But Allah's so much better. Should I be focused on the results? I want paradise. I don't want to go to hell. Or is there more? And it's just so much more wonderful. It's not that I won't get paradise. I'll get paradise. But there's something loftier, something indescribable, something Allah just says vaguely in the Quran. He says, "Wa ridwanum min Allah akbar." The pleasure of God is so much greater. Why settle for a minimalist approach to Islam where I'm just focused on my results and I'm not happy? And he says, ذَلِكَ هُوَ الْفَوْزُ الْعَظِيمُ. That is the great success.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Kari.
Can we not see how the planets look like diamonds in the sky? And everything on earth was created for you and I. Can we not see merely waiting for the final day to arrive? To arrive. Do we feel a deeper meaning to it all? And in our creation, there are no
welcome to another edition of Face to Face. My name is Dieter Reinisch, and you're joining us today from the UN headquarters in Vienna. With me today is the Deputy Foreign Minister of Belarus, Igor Segreta. Igor Segreta has been here in Vienna for the 32nd Ministerial Conference of the OSCE and for a meeting with the IAEA Director General, Raffaele Grossi. Mr. Segreta, you just came from a meeting with IAEA Director General Raffaele Grossi. What was the purpose of your meeting? What was on the agenda?
You know, each and every time I'm visiting Vienna, I'm looking for new contacts. I'm visiting our partners and friends. We strictly cooperate, and the agency, Atomic International Atomic Agency, is one of our key partners. Because, as you might know, we've created a new industry. We've built a nuclear power plant, and we did that from the start, from the decision to build the new nuclear power plant till the finishing of it and bringing it into action, into exploitation. We've been relying and we will looking for assistance of International Atomic Energy Agency, and we're very helpful for them, for their very professional and very timely assistance.
You just mentioned it, you are expanding your existing nuclear power plant. You are recently, President Lukashenko announced to build a third unit. Why did Belarus decide to put more such a large focus on peaceful nuclear energy?
Well, it's natural, I think. As soon as we see the energy consumption growing, we had to modernize our generation capacities. So we've seen the efficiency and the outcome of the nuclear power plant, modern technology, the highest level of security. You know, for Belarus, we are very vulnerable in that sense, because we've had a tragedy in 1986 in Chernobyl, and Belarus was severely contaminated by the radiation after that. So for some years, we had to persuade people that peaceful and very modern and very secure atomic energy can bring substantial results for the economy. As I mentioned, the energy consumption is growing each and every year. People, regular citizens, they buy more and more electrical cars, more and more public transportation means is driven by the electricity. We started developing the mining capacities for cryptocurrency, and we're looking for the data center creation. Belarus is a developed IT country that puts a lot of attention to that sector. Well, that's why we see the trend and we follow it just.
You mentioned the constructive cooperation with the IAEA in regards to peaceful nuclear energy, but at the same time, we've witnessed in particular the last 2 years heated debates here in this building, here in Vienna, at the Board of Governors meetings, at the General Conference of the IAEA, in relation to ongoing armed conflicts around the world, both in Middle East, West Asia, and in Eastern Europe. Two of your neighboring countries, Russia and Ukraine, are at war at the moment. And there is debate on security of nuclear plants in Ukraine, also in the Kursk region. There are regular attacks in the vicinity of these nuclear plants. How do you see the role of the IAEA in these conflicts?
IAEA has the highest ever reputation in that sphere, and represents a big majority of countries that have the atomic capacities on their territory, and they know that security in that sphere is crucial. So in the ongoing conflict, I think, and you've heard that on the conference, President suggested that we should introduce a ban for the attacks on critical infrastructure objects. and we should protect them properly, and we should mobilize the support of the international community, meaning the protection. I meant also the ban for imposing sanctions on the industries, countries that utilize the atomic energy, because that might bring to the some shortages of spare parts or some technologies that are crucially sufficient and necessary for providing the security. So definitely those capacities, atomic capacities, should be duly protected, and because the explosion on them could bring to the easily bring to the situation that we've had on the Chernobyl reactor in 1986 and in any other countries. And this could contaminate vast territories, big territories in Europe. So for our own security, we should do a lot and persuade the international community, and the International Atomic Agency could do a good job in that, persuading their members to refrain from attacking the NPPs.
Which is actually the statute of the IAEA, but still in June, such attacks happened. The US and Israel attacked Iranian sites, nuclear sites. In reaction to that, unfortunately, Director General Gross refused to condemn these attacks. And at the General Conference in September, a resolution had been tabled by Russia, China, and Iran, and also supported by your country, Belarus, to refrain from these attacks. How do you see the situation now that even in the 21st century, it is still necessary to table a motion that says we are against attacks on peaceful nuclear facilities?
I think that we are still a little bit far from getting the long-standing solution for that. But I can only confirm that Belarus will support each and every effort that will bring more protection, more security, and more peace, even if there are some dispute or conflict appears. We were following attentively, I think many people, many politicians in our region and outside were worried about the situation which took place in Iran. And I think that exactly not by weapons, not by means of military forces, any obstacles, any disputes could be solved. This is the job of the international employees, international agencies, politicians and diplomats. And that's what we're interested to do. We do believe in a classical diplomacy without fakes, without assaults, attacks on each other. That's what we see now on the OEC premises in the United Nations. People sometimes blame secretariats of these organizations for not providing a proper assistance or just infrastructure or getting some events which would suit them. But, you know, I would like to draw your attention that the secretariats, they just serve the countries, and the atmosphere which is now in Vienna, in Geneva, in New York, and in other European and world capitals is just like this, like the countries are representing themselves on these sides. So we have to start, and we've talked about that with Director General of the Atomic Agency, that we do believe that politicians from countries active in that sphere, in the sphere of security, in atomic energy, in the conflict settlement, they will be more polite and they will be more constructive in discussing modern challenges.
And you just mentioned the OSCE, that was, so to say, the second purpose of your visit to Vienna, the 32nd Ministerial Conference of the OSCE that took place here in Vienna this week. And I followed the conference very closely. I listened to the speeches over the past 2 days, and listening to the speeches, the constant attacks both on Belarus and Russia from every single minister, delegate, and representative. One might wonder, why are you attending the OSCE conference in such an atmosphere?
Because we do believe in the spirit of Helsinki. We believe in the force of real classical diplomacy. We do believe in the future of this organization, which can be a very effective instrument in for the conflict settlement. That's what it has been designed for. You're absolutely right. What we see in Hofburg recent years, is just the throwing to each other the national statements. But unlike many other countries from Europe and other regions, we each and every time try to persuade our partners, try to find the solutions, try to mobilize the support, try to find the not politically biased topics that we could discuss in smaller groups, in some formats that are not non-discriminatory for other participants. And I think what we are now lacking at the OSCE premises is the talks about the participation of Russia and security for Russia. Because what has started in Ukraine, it was the lack of security for Russia itself, with the NATO expansion, with the collapse of Soviet Union, with the collapse of the international architecture, with the collapse of that spirit of Helsinki that brought people from different countries with different views to the same table, which finalized with the final act, Helsinki Final Act in 1975. So I do believe in the power and force of diplomacy, and I hope we will shortly bring to an end to that conflict, and we will restore the trust and enhance the confidence building measures.
But as I said, listening to the speech and also following other international organizations, one becomes very pessimistic that this approach is even possible. Instead of what you said, the spirit of Helsinki in 1975, the idea of closing the gap between different blocs, presenting a space for dialogue, now we see a clear split in all international organizations, the introductions of sanctions against states, just like your state, but also other states, Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, and the so-called sanctions regime from the West is tightening. How you assess, in general, the Eurasian security architecture at the moment?
Well, I think that we should bring the security issues in a broader context than Europe itself. We should expand it to the whole continent, Eurasian continent, and that's what we are doing regularly in Minsk since already 3 years. The newest edition of the conference took place in October, end of October in Minsk, and every year it gathering more and more participants. We enhance the level of political participants from different countries, and we try to attract as many attention as we can, transforming this event to the unlike-minded event. We are not seeking support and looking only for our friends. We are also inviting those who will not support us, but they will understand our motivation, our efforts, and will someday they will bring some also support and income to that format. I do agree with you that the situation is far from ideal, from being too peaceful, but if we stop talking, if we close the doors, we will bring the world and the region to the war, the global war, or to the full-scale war in the region. That's what we don't want to do. And our intention is not to make everyone agree with us. The intention was to make everyone understand what we mean, and we could also understand the intentions of the other side. That brings, because the war is being often starts when people don't talk to each other and they don't understand each other. This misunderstanding it enhances the level of conflict potential. Conference is a good format. You participated in that, and I think you felt the atmosphere of Minsk spirit, so to say, and we will continue. We are not substituting OSCE in any case. OSCE is an international organization where we could do the three traditional baskets, our cooperation, and the conference is the awareness building, is the spreading of information, and gaining support from countries that are worried by the problems in Eurasian security. Well, you've seen the number of participants from big Eurasia, from different countries, from different analytics reviewers and specialists in international relations. I like this atmosphere we've created, and I do believe that we will go further, because it has become an annual event in Minsk.
By strengthening Eurasian security at the same time, when you look at the Western media, the Western politicians, they accuse Belarus of undermining European security. Very often you hear this example of using migrants to undermine Western European security. What do you say to this argument?
Well, we don't use anyone. Migrants are trying to cross the border illegally via our territory because they are desperate about the situation in their countries, of origin. And they use our territory to get to a better life. But what they see on the border, they see the cruel pushbacks, they see the unwelcome approach from the authorities of the neighboring countries. They don't see any even procedures, refugees procedures or asylum seekers procedures. They don't see the, and they, are being disappointed. And we see less and less those poor people on our borders. We try to persuade our partners that we should return to the format of building shelters for those people. We should do something to improve situations in their countries of origin. And Belarus is very much engaged in that process. You've noticed probably the visits of our president, of our prime minister, our minister of foreign affairs to Asian countries, to African countries, where we create jobs, where we supply our technologies and equipment. And that brings more trust, more confidence, and we are happy that our turnover is increasing in food, in products, in machinery, and so on. So I think that the illegal migration is a problem that we could combat only together. Throwing the claims on some countries, that doesn't help to change the situation for the best. So we call upon international community and our neighbors and countries of origin of those migrants to sit and see together what could be done to improve the situation. Commenting your remarks on the Eurasian security, I would like to know that the main problem mostly lays that some parties want to win, but we all win if the war will not start. That will be the win. We should not collapse or bring some countries to collapse as they did with the Soviet Union. On the political map of Europe, each and every country today presents a guarantee that something bad will not happen, that the military conflict will not break out. You see what happened in Ukraine. That's because of lack of confidence and lack of security granted for all countries. You cannot be secured if you bring insecurity to your neighbors. So the neighborhood, we consider the neighborhood is the main asset that we have to share and we have to preserve with all our neighbors. And I mentioned that numerously on the OSCE premises. We don't want to see the NATO at our borders. We want to see Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Poland, Ukraine, and Russia. As in the sense of neighborhood, it's vital for us.
At the same time, you mentioned avoiding a war. The world is moving into a new direction towards a multipolar world. The North American domination is clearly coming to an end, but particularly the European Union is unwilling to accept it. We recently see the introduction of the Rearm Europe program, conscription in France, in Germany, building massive armies. They even talk about we need to go to war against Russia. How can a war actually be avoided?
Well, the war could be avoided with the perception that it will bring no victory to some separate countries. This will bring blood, victims, destructed infrastructure. Unfortunately, those who rearm their armies and enhance the level of militarization, they have forgotten about the pain and tragedy that war has brought to their countries. And I think that, I do believe that we don't need a new war to understand that. Because war is very expensive, very unpredictable, and it will, and it economically it's not efficient means of solving the problems. The only efficient way, maybe long, but longer than the military conflict, but longer, but very stable, and will bring more profit when we sit and again discuss things instead of militarize, put money, pump money into the military and military budgets, and enhance the military industry, and enhance the army, because it's not economically necessary, and it will bring the traditional spheres of the economy to a collapse.
But at the same time, we see increasingly a move of some states to work outside the international law framework. United States, Israel, with their attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities, breaking international law, and these attacks had no consequences for these countries, no consequences at the UN Security Council. How can international rule-based order re-established?
You know, the architecture, international architecture, and the rule of law has been not destroyed, but in a bad shape at the moment. I agree with you. How could we restore that? By restoring confidence, by restoring trust, by showing each other that we respect international law, which has been created by many generations before us. And we should create new mechanisms that will help to build, rebuild it, that and restore that trust and confidence. I do agree with you that the secretariats of international organizations, often monopolized by certain countries' representatives, that don't want to talk about any appeasement, any peaceful solution on different matters. And what the Security Council, as I mentioned, reflects the current state of the intergovernmental relations. So sooner or later, I believe in the force of diplomacy, we will sit and decide that, because many countries that are trying to support a military operation in Ukraine, they realize that their communities are lacking something very substantial: social standards, the energy tariffs, the cost of living is not as it used to be even 5 or 10 years ago. So I think the policy makers should realize that they are specifically designed and brought to their positions not to start the wars, but to finish, end up the conflicts, and to settle problems, and make their best to enhance the standard of living for their population, for their communities. People are against the war, that's evident, but on the West, they are frightened, they are scared by everyday's reports, information reports, saying that one country is an aggressor, somebody there is their supporters, and so on. But, you know, this is today's everyday's routine, unfortunately. But I do believe that the glass is more than half full than empty. So we are doing, you know, with our colleagues, a lot of job at the moment to find right formats and right solutions in the sphere of international relations in our region. And the topic number one on my desk every day is the security issues, situation on the border, and relations with the neighbors.
And final question, coming back to the Third Eurasian Security Conference in Minsk, really high profile conference if you look at the participants, contrary to the OSCE meeting in Vienna at the moment. We saw personal participation of the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. We saw high-profile representation from many other countries like China, Hungary, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the Deputy Foreign Minister of Iran. But I'm wondering how this conference and the debate and discussions at this conference can be turned into practice to strengthen Eurasian security.
It's already been transferred into a practice, because as a follow-up, we see the numerous consultations between the ministries, we see the interaction of analytical community, we continue the meetings in a smaller formats of representatives that were part of our conference. We see the articles, and we see the effects in, you know, more predictable and friendly relations between countries participating on that conference. We see new perspectives for the trade turnover and economic relations. I think that the money spent to organize that conference, we've saved a lot of resources due to that event. More and more people do believe what they saw with their own eyes and do not believe in what they read or hear every day from TV or from internet. They see how country looks like, they see how people are living, and that even enhances the diplomatic efforts that we maintain every day.
Thank you very much, Mr. Deputy Foreign Minister Igor Segretta. That's all we have time for now. Thank you for joining us from the UN headquarters, the Vienna International Center, here on Face to Face, and goodbye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Good afternoon to all our listeners. You are tuning to Iran Radio. Nice to have you with us. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. Muslim scholar Ibn al-Haytham, known as al-Hazan in Europe, who was born in 965 AD, formulated the scientific method and has been referred to as the world's first true scientist. He is also often regarded as the first theoretical physicist, making a significant contribution to the theory of light and optics. Additionally, he developed what is called celestial mechanics, which led to the eventual work of Europeans such as Copernicus, Galileo, Johannes Kepler, and Isaac Newton. We'll listen to the continuation of Iran Radio. Thank you for joining us. We start off this hour's programs with our news bulletin. That will be followed by Kids Corner. The program is all about children and child's play, a fun program specially made for children. And we round up this hour with our varied radio productions feature.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.